How's it, guys? Sorry I couldn't join you this Friday. I'm currently on a plane over the Atlantic going to New York to watch the Ryder Cup. So damn excited. Bethpage Black, it's going to be really incredible. So even if you aren't a major golf fan like I am, you can still watch the Ryder Cup this weekend because it's going to be all-out warfare. I mean, golf is golf, obviously, but it's as close as we'll ever get to like contact sport within the game. The American crowds on the east side are so rough, and it's already been rough the whole week. So lots of verbal abuse. Europe against all odds, trying for the win. First time they're going to win this since 2012, then get it done. And the Americans desperately trying to get the trophy back. So that's a major highlight for the weekend. Another big highlight for the weekend, of course, is the Boca versus Argentina in Durban. That game will be at 5 o'clock. The Bocs have to win this one, and they probably have to win next one as well in London. It's so tightly contested, this rugby championship this year. It's been the best one ever. And Argentina are going to be so, so tough this weekend in Durban. They've actually been there for quite a while now. Not just because they want to pick up Durban chicks, but they just want to actually really make sure they can give themselves the best chance of winning this match. So the Bocs are going to be up against the best Argentinian team probably ever, which is going to make for a really cool spectacle. So this weekend, major action in the Rugby Championship. The game before that, Australia versus New Zealand, will be around 7 o'clock from Eden Park. Another big one to watch. So Rugby Championship, Ryder Cup, that's just weekend sport. I will see you back next weekend. Follow me on social media for updates from the Bethpage itself. Oh, this is so exciting.
All right. Well, I told you at the beginning of the show we're going to talk to some people who are going to discuss with us new and interesting ways of doing investment. And also, it's about time. I know Bitcoin Bit in the comments is going to be excited as hell about this. But it's time we talked about crypto again, because it's been a while since we've had a regular thing on the show about crypto. But I was one of those people who in the beginning was a major early adopter. I loved the stuff. I bought a whole lot. I've bought and sold along the way. I think many people have. Some people have totally fallen off the wagon. Some people are so on the wagon that they're never going to sell. Their Bitcoin's going to go to the grave with them. But we'll find out this morning from somebody I actually know quite well, Warren Wheatley, who's also the CEO of the Africa Bitcoin Corporation. Is that it?
Yep.
But also AltVest. And I've seen all the AltVest billboards up all over the place. Congrats on that, Warren. It's going well, huh?
Yeah, no, it's going great. Thanks.
Yeah, it's nice to see you. And also, Stafford Maisie, who is the Director of Bitcoin Strategy. Stafford, nice to see you.
Nice to meet you.
Wearing the Bitcoin branding. I love it.
T-shirt.
All right. Yeah. So you guys are obviously true believers in the crypto world. But what's been happening? Give us a couple of updates, and particularly for South Africans who are looking to invest differently. What kinds of things have happened since we last discussed this, which is probably 3 years ago on this show?
Should I tackle it from like an industry neutral perspective first, and then we'll get into kind of us?
Sure.
So obviously we represent Africa Bitcoin Corporation, and that's a name change for AltVest. But I think for South Africans, what's happened in the country is quite profound over the last 36 months. I'm personally very engaged in an advisory capacity with the South African Reserve Bank, with the Johannesburg Stock Exchange, with a group within the South African Reserve Bank called the IFWG. It's an intergovernmental fintech working group. Right. And these are the folks writing the legislation for crypto in South Africa. And we've been very forward-thinking. We've issued out clear legislation for folks that want to custody crypto and do crypto. So there's licenses that have been issued out. The JSE has now allowed us to launch a company in the way and the form that we've launched. So they're watching it. They're watching it closely. And I think we're quite excited about what's happening from an industry perspective, allowing this stuff to happen. Because the problem with crypto 3 years ago was regulatory nervousness. Like didn't know.
What has happened in that respect? Because you mentioned the Reserve Bank. And yeah. I met with some people a while ago, probably about a year and a half ago, about what the relationships are now in this working group that you're talking about between the Reserve Bank. Obviously, the Department of Finance are in the background there looking too, because they want to know from a SARS point of view how you tax these kinds of things. Have we made major progress? Are there people in government who actually understand crypto?
Yeah, we do. We've made major progress. In fact, since we've engaged, clauses have actually changed. So there was a clause that clearly stated that no company on the Johannesburg Stock Exchange could actually issue out a security, i.e. a share, directly linked to crypto. Based upon our engagement and the forward-looking aspects that we see in the governmental departments, those clauses have been settled and they're gone. So we are capable of doing that now. But absolutely. But I think the big challenge in the industry is having tools to manage the industry. You know, it's not just an understanding, and the tools are still growing up. So as much as our decision makers want to do things that are forward thinking, they also have to keep up with the maturity of the tools as they're growing. And it's happening now. So yeah, absolutely. I think the people that we have at Saab are incredible. The people that we have at the Johannesburg Stock Exchange are really, really good.
Okay.
SARS, Fisker, you name it. So our government is actually one of the most forward looking and mature in this regard in the world.
Well, as I mentioned at the start of this, the Bitcoin Butt is one of the regulars here. He's got, I think he's currently, because we do this, we check on who the top fan, he's number one in the comments this morning, I had no doubt. He says, I'll add my comment. Yeah. There is no better investment than Bitcoin. I took out two loans against my Bitcoin and applied for the third this morning. Only Bitcoin. Fuck crypto.
I think he's absolutely, and I think it's not facetious. I think there's two aspects of that I've been trying to work with the legislators in South Africa is to remove Bitcoin from crypto.
Yeah.
Because Bitcoin is a digital commodity. It's digital property. It's the immaculate conception, right? It's the Satoshi Nakamoto. It's got the guy that made it is gone.
You're giving it a lot of superlatives here.
Yeah, but I mean, it's the one that stands alone versus any of the others. And we have to, as a country, to legislate this world well and proper, you have to take a digital commodity that has complete sovereignty, autonomous.
You can't have
crypto.
A capricious government deciding what the value of your currency is and making terrible decisions and costing the people of that country. We've seen it happen. I mean, the South African economy keeps suffering because we have people who are making terrible decisions about the value of our money on a daily basis. Bitcoin is the best way to safeguard against that, and it's got nothing to do with any government.
Yeah, and I think it's a good segue to kind of what Warren and team have done. Yeah, you know, what we've done is we've taken Altvest Capital, converted it to African Bitcoin Corporation. And I think it serves a demand and like a different set of people looking for exposure to this asset class. Yeah, maybe you want to give us some insight.
Well, let's start with who are those people? Because there are people who already know and who own Bitcoin through various things. Maybe they've got their own wallet. Maybe they're buying it on an exchange. Maybe they've got some kind of trading platform that they use. What are you offering?
So when you start thinking about what a Bitcoin treasury company is, there's been a well of them recently, I think over 200. There's a website called bitcointreasuries.net.
Mm-hmm.
And they track every single one of these Bitcoin treasury companies, whether they're private, public, governmental, whatever. There's over 200 at last count, right? So you got to ask yourself, one of the first questions we get is, why would I just not buy Bitcoin myself? Now, a Bitcoin treasury company is a company that goes out and accumulates Bitcoin on its balance sheet. That's step one. Step two is, what do you actually do with the Bitcoin once it's on your balance sheet? And we've seen different strategies emerge, some successful, others not so successful. And the idea is that the Bitcoin company can buy Bitcoin quicker and more effectively than an individual could. That's the sort of high-level thesis. A company's got more levers than an individual has.
Like, so is it essentially a bit of arbitrage? I mean, you can kind of get in there, you cost a little less, move a little faster.
Those are some of the levers, but not the major ones, right? So a corporation, as an example, can access capital markets. You can go to the bond market and say, give me $2 billion, and then you can go and buy Bitcoin with it. An individual can't do that. I've tried. They say no. Right? You've also got the ability to issue equity, and that's important. Now, so what these companies do, the trend has been to, you start issuing equity. In other words, you ask people to become shareholders in the business and you go out and buy Bitcoin.
Mm-hmm.
And you hope the Bitcoin goes up and with it, your equity value, and then you can issue more. So oftentimes people say, but that's dilutive because you keep issuing shares.
Mm.
But the kind of folk who like these investments are less concerned about being diluted from a shareholding perspective, which governs the percentage you own in the company. What they're more worried about is, do I own more Bitcoin per share I own?
Right.
So in other words, if you just buy one Bitcoin, or even if you buy a Bitcoin ETF, the amount of Bitcoin you own remains static over time.
Correct.
Right? But if I buy one Bitcoin, sorry, if I buy one share in the Africa Bitcoin Corporation, and Stafford and I's job is to get more Bitcoin per share. So you'll start off with, let's say, one Bitcoin per share.
Mm-hmm.
But through our activity, in a year's time, hopefully you own two Bitcoin per share on a look-through basis, and so on and so on. And so we use different capital market levers to ensure we can buy more Bitcoin and increase your Bitcoin per share. And that's the major metric that people look at when gauging the success of these companies. But why would we do it? We're trying to think of novel ways to use the Bitcoin. And what we've sculpted for ourselves is true to Altvest's ethos. So Altvest was always envisioned to be a company that generates access to capital markets and to assets that people can't ordinarily get access to. So Bitcoin is a natural progression of what we do. But moreover, we also provide funding to SMEs. Mm-hmm. So that part of Altvest continues to exist. It's just called Altvest Capital Solutions.
Right.
And it's a division of the Africa Bitcoin Corporation. Now, the way to think about us is, and this is a great segue into the history discussion you guys were having. If you look at the history of banks, the history of insurance companies, and how they structured themselves using various instruments over time. Mostly it was government bonds or treasury bills, gold sometimes. Mm. And those have proven effective up to a point in terms of galvanizing a balance sheet. But, you know, if a bond drops in half, suddenly a bank's capital adequacy drops in half and they've got to make a call on shareholders and that kind of thing. So in our country, for example, you have this concept called the shareholder of reference.
Mm-hmm.
That needs to be loaded that anytime those kind of shocks to the system happen, you can just tap them for equity. Now, that's not something that a Bitcoin treasury company would go through if you manage your balance sheet correctly. So instead of putting, you know, soybeans on our balance sheet or oil or gold or government bonds or money market, we've got Bitcoin. What that's going to do over time is give us an almost indestructible balance sheet that allows us to go into capital markets and command better interest rates from capital markets.
So who would you be replacing here? Like brokers and people in the investment world?
I think the question is not replace. So it's kind of augmentation. So if you let's get back to the question.
Well, I mean, this is quite novel because you're buying shares in a company where you guys are overall increasing the value over time. Not just with Bitcoin, but primarily that's going to be the spine of the whole thing. And then you're going to add other things to it. I mean, that sounds like a very interesting idea. And I think probably a lot of people would go, that's more likely to be a good investment over time because of the Bitcoin than if I had to buy shares in a construction company or if I had to buy shares in a gold mining company. Right? So I think we get that part.
Yeah, that's true. But coming back to like who's the addressable market for this,
I think
you get the Bitcoiners, the folks that want to own Bitcoin.
Yeah.
They're the cypherpunks, not your keys, not your coin. They want to hold their stuff in cold storage on ledger sticks. They want to, you know, imprint key phrases onto metal and steel. Those folks we love, and we continually love that, and we want people to always do that. But there's folks that are not cypherpunks, and I think those folks want to own a security. They want to own something like a share. They don't want to own cold storage. They don't want to know anything about cold storage.
Right.
And I think for them, a security like this makes a lot of sense. I buy the share, and it gives me exposure to Bitcoin. I like that. Okay, I'm not a cypherpunk, never going to be. I'm a high net worth individual. I'm going to buy 60 million rands worth of Bitcoin. Don't tell me about not your keys, not your coin. This is a great thing.
Right.
Then you get somebody that wants levered exposure. So like Warren said, they want to outperform Bitcoin. Mm. So that's our role. Africa Bitcoin Corporation exists to outperform Bitcoin all the time. And what we mean by that is we want to increase the BTC yield, the Bitcoin yield in our business, which means we want to accretively dilute, increment the Bitcoin, and give you more Bitcoin per share. That's what we're all about. Now, people that love that of folks that want more Bitcoin per share, but also capital markets, fixed income markets, pension funds. There's so many pools of capital in the world that represent about $400 to $500 trillion. That can't get exposure to Bitcoin.
Many of those pools of money, and we know that even in this country, despite the predations of so many, there are still people who are trying to look after their investments. There are these massive stockpiles of money that people have saved or invested and that has been put aside for them for their retirement or whatever it might be. And are they nervous about Bitcoin still, or are they starting to look at investments the way you're talking about them this morning?
I think if you want to understand our world and why we're doing it, it's not to understand Bitcoin better than to understand fiat more.
Yeah.
Debasement is a big issue.
Huge.
Right, huge. So inflation, interest rates.
Mm-hmm.
Very simply put, we always say this, your groceries are not getting more expensive. Your money is getting weaker.
Yes.
That's the basis of what's happening in the fiat world today. So mm-hmm. just like if we pause there, if you can understand that to the depth that you need to understand it, then you'll understand how broken money is. And why does the money break? Why does the money get weaker? Why, when you store as a young person your time and energy in a bank, that 5 years later the buying power has dropped by 40 to 50%? That, you know, that's the same challenge a corporation has. Where do you put your money today? Do you go buy government bonds? Do you go buy other things? So what's in the world today, there's about $500 trillion of capital in the world. And we're talking savings, etc., trying to run away from debasement, trying to run away from money getting weaker. And we need perfect money. And Bitcoin is that perfect base because it's so scarce. The 21 million, it's getting scarcer, it's getting scarcer. And in that scarcity lies the value.
Okay, so Warren, I mean, you guys at African Bitcoin Corporation, you're talking about putting money into small and medium businesses that can create jobs, because we know that it's all good and well for people who are smart enough and agile enough to be able to move money around, whatever money they have, and then invest carefully, and they can make good returns on that if they're smart. And clearly what you're proposing here is smart too. But most people are just trying to survive. And in South Africa, we've got major unemployment problems. We don't live in a vacuum. You don't live on an island. You've got to pay attention to your surroundings. And clearly, those small and medium businesses need a bit of help because they're the only ones who can lift the economy up. So what's the association there, and how does that come into it?
All right. So when we first started Altvest Capital, the idea was to create to connect capital to ideas, right? So we found a novel way using a perpetual preference share to fund equity positions in businesses. That, incidentally, is the same way guys like Strategy are now funding Bitcoin purchases.
Mm-hmm.
So it's technology we had developed as, in fact, South Africa was the first listed exchange ever to issue these perpetual preference shares. That was an Altvest invention.
Nice.
It's been used across the world now. The only difference is we used it to buy like the family restaurant in Melville and a few others. We also then quickly realized that equity wasn't the solution for everyone. Some people just want a loan. They want to get their business going, give you the money back, and carry on. So we created a fund called the Altvest Credit Opportunities Fund. That's the one where you'll see it's girls with big hair and funny glasses. So it's
I drove past one this morning.
Yeah. That is structured to give businesses low-cost loans. Now, low-cost in this environment means...
Because the banks aren't helping them, right?
Yeah. Altvest Capital has a loan with an overdraft with Nedbank.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm going to go out and say it.
Go on.
The overdraft is secured with cash.
Yeah.
Right. That's the collateral they demanded.
Right.
That's ridiculous.
I mean, why would you ever need an overdraft if you already have the cash?
Now, the only reason I was able to do that is because of our treasury. We need to keep treasury assets because we're a financial services business.
Mm-hmm.
So I had to keep the cash anyway. But in the ordinary course of events, I would have told them,
get screwed.
Makes no sense. Yeah.
But then this shows you again the plight, and I love this idea of these loans and the equity arrangements that you make with businesses, because the access to capital is often what keeps them either in a very, very survival-based state, or they actually go under. They can't sustain the business because they can't get access to money.
So let me just paint the picture here, right? Once you're escorted out of Standard Bank's lobby after your loan's been declined, the next stop you make is one of the SME funders, right?
Yeah.
And there's lots of them. There's not a lack of funders. What the problem is that your starting loan is 36% per annum.
It's like the Mashonisas, eh?
Yeah. 3% a month, those kind of rates.
Right. Crippling.
But the cool thing is, and one of the best things about what we do is we meet South African entrepreneurs.
Yeah.
A guy who can run a business paying off a loan at 36% is an absolute rock star.
Yes.
So we try and get below 20.
Mm-hmm.
We have to do secured loans, and we get money from pension funds and other long-term investors. Excuse me. Now, where does Bitcoin fit into this? I don't have a balance sheet right now, right? So it's a long slog where I have to say, give me $150 million. I promise I'll use it responsibly. If I lose it, there's probably nothing you can do to me because you can see the balance sheet. Pension funds, to their credit, are still taking the risk in pursuance of this objective.
Yeah, but you didn't come out of nowhere. I mean, you've run some big companies, so you've got a reputation.
Yeah.
People know and trust you.
But the point is, if we build up a balance sheet, let's say got 21,000 Bitcoin on it, funded mostly by equity, that discussion's a lot easier.
Mm.
Then I can go to sovereign wealth funds and say, give me debt at 8% and I promise to give it to entrepreneurs at 10%. I can't have that discussion if I don't have a balance sheet.
Sure.
Or if I've got a balance sheet that's filled with Mexican pesos or something else. So that's the idea. And that's where Bitcoin fits into the picture, is that it's going to make those kinds of discussions a lot easier. And we want to pass that. We want to use that pristine asset to access cheap capital to pass it on to SMEs.
I also think there's a beautiful play that's very synergistic with the traditional altcoin business. So in the United States, they've discussed it. They call it bit bonds.
Mm-hmm.
So the United States government is thinking about taking their treasuries and mixing it up with Bitcoin. So if you buy a treasury, like a 10-year, for whatever the price may be, 90% of it is fiat and 10% of it goes to Bitcoin. And that Bitcoin, as it matures, can either pay off the loan. So what we could do is a bit bond with the SMME. So if you make a 5 million rand loan,
mm-hmm.
we'll give you 4 million rand, and maybe 1 million rand goes towards a Bitcoin purchase that
right.
we hold in the treasury. And as Bitcoin grows, it could outperform your loan and settle it, and it becomes the an additional securitization pillar underneath the facility that we provide you. And this is how we could kind of cross-pollinate into our treasury, and we could Bitcoinize SMMEs in South Africa.
But there are still those people running around saying, Bitcoin's not going to go up anymore, and it's this is its ceiling, and it's not going to get any better. Obviously, you guys don't believe that, or you wouldn't be doing what you're doing. Is there still a large cohort of traditional business people, investors, these corporations who've made these decisions for 100 years, who will just not touch anything to do with Bitcoin?
But that's why we're so early.
Yeah.
But that's the point.
They are still there, right?
Yeah, they're there. But for my technological experience, I mean, I saw in the early 90s, I saw the internet. I worked for Telkom, and we saw the internet before the internet had a user interface. We told everyone how big it was going to be. People said, no way. Then in the late 90s, we saw open source software.
Right.
We kind of knew how big that was going to be, and people said, no way. The dot-com thing happened and boozed me. I've constantly seen this from a technological perspective, where people kind of underestimate something, and then when they learn about it, they overestimate something, and then they again underestimate it in the long term. And I think from a Bitcoin perspective, the ups and downs, for us, it's an asset class that is probably the most undervalued in the entire world today.
And speaking of asset classes, I mean, there are new ways of investing in new things, renewable energy, property, sport, entertainment. How does all of that work, Warren?
From an AltVest perspective? So we use this perpetual preference share mechanism to give people access to those kinds of assets.
Just what is that? Because you touched on it earlier. You said it's been adopted across other stock exchanges in the world, and you guys invented that.
Yeah, I think. Or put it into play. Yeah, I think so.
Okay. Cool.
So what a perpetual preference share is that it's an instrument that can be issued by a company. Now, this sounds off the bat horrible for an investor. So it's like taking a loan. It doesn't rank. It's not as secure as a loan. And it's preferred over your ordinary shares. So in the capital stack of a company, you've got the ordinary shares. Those are the last survivors and the guys who get paid last in the event of failure. Then you've got preference shareholders. And then you've got debt. Now, debt, by its nature, must be paid back. Mm-hmm. You take a loan, and you determine when and how you're going to give it back. Now, a preference share can be either redeemable, in which case it means the company at some point is going to give it back, or it could be perpetual. Now, perpetual means you're never going to give the money back. The owner of that instrument will own it forever unless they sell it on the secondary market. What that does is it takes all the pressure of performance off the company.
Right.
And so you can go ahead, you get equity, which doesn't need to be serviced, and you get none of the covenants of debt that need to go with it, and none of the pressure associated with debt. So we use that instrument to give people access to private equity. Now, one of the reasons private equity is not accessible to ordinary people is because, number one, you need large amounts of money to participate, but you also need patience, right? So a typical private equity transaction is 15 years. You get 10-year vintages, 12-year, but typically 15, and that's how long you need to wait to see your returns. So it's not the kind of investment that if you overspend in December, you can cash in January, and someone will cash it in for you, but they'll give you 10 cents in the rand. So we created this perpetual instrument that people could buy and sell on the exchange, and we use the funds to buy private equity, and we hold it on their behalf. But them wanting to exit, they can sell on the market, and it doesn't disrupt the underlying asset. Okay. So that's the technology we use to make private equity accessible. And it's the same thing with a Bitcoin treasury company. We take the investment from the public, use it to buy Bitcoin and develop the strategy. And they can exit at will without putting pressure on and disrupting the strategy of the business by me having to redeem it.
Yeah, because there were some questions about that too. So I think you just answered a few of those as well about how you buy and sell, for example, because you know, a lot of people are used to using exchanges, and then they can go on there and decide in a minute what you want to do. Buy, sell, put in more, whatever you need to do.
Now, for sports teams, as an example, we try to use this to fund the Springboks.
Okay.
They're not interested. But
no, we're still going to go at it, though. Yeah. We want to buy the Springboks.
Yeah, but I mean, what do you mean, buy them?
So they try to do a private equity deal, which is one of the worst deals people, and that's why there was such a fuss. All the upside was with the private equity buyers.
Mm-hmm.
And there were large amounts of debt. Now, the problem with a sports team and debt is you don't want to have to sell 10 of your best players when the debt becomes due, right?
Well, it could be called slavery, so that's not a good idea.
Yeah, but sell it to another team or the transfers, that kind of stuff. So what you want is this kind of instrument so that you can run the team.
Yeah.
And, you know, if the fan changes allegiance, he can sell out that share and buy something else.
Okay.
At the same time, you know, how many how many Bafana flags can you own? So the idea is you would buy one flag and 10 shares. And that could be that could be your certificate that shows how big a fan you are.
Right.
You've seen that stadium.
And you're technically an owner, right?
Yeah.
Not technically, you are an owner.
Well, yes, but I mean, for a lot of people, it's about other people knowing that they're an owner. Yeah, so you've got that certificate, you're happy.
Yeah, you've seen guys at stadiums, right?
Yes.
To prove themselves as a fan, they've got 8 scarves on, right? And 5
and
hats.
Makarapa and
they take the share certificate, so a screenshot of their Easy Equity.
I'm an owner, yeah.
And then it allows, for example, the sports team to cool things. So if you reach, say, 10,000 shares, you can come and watch practices, as an example, those kind of things. So it's a way to monetize. And
for the sports team, then they have access to capital.
Mm.
Yeah. No, it makes a lot of sense. I think this is terrific. Because there are going to be lots of people who are interested in this. And if you are interested in finding out more about Altvest 2, where can we go?
So we've got a website now, the Africa Bitcoin Corporation.
ABC, just remember that. African Bitcoin Corporation.
So spell it out. It's long. If you can spell it.
Africa Bitcoin Corporation. Not African Bitcoin. AfricaBitcoinCorporation.com.
And on there, you'll see all the investment opportunities and also how to buy. So the shares are on, we're doing a book build right now.
Mm-hmm.
It's called the Africa Bitcoin Corporation for a very specific reason.
What is that reason?
It's going to be for Africa. Now, a lot of people make noise about that and pretend that they are pan-African.
Yeah.
One of the things... Steph made a comment that people overestimate things sometimes. One of the things we overestimate is the interconnectivity of our money systems. In some ways, we're very connected. But you try and buy a share in Nigeria. Impossible. You have someone in the U.S. try to buy a share in the JSE. 3 weeks into your KYC, you're going to give up. And so what we've gone ahead and done is set out a schedule where we're going to be listing on exchanges throughout Africa to make those local communities able to access the instrument easier. And that's not just talk. Next week, Thursday, we do our first listing in Namibia. We've got a schedule. We will see Botswana, Nigeria, Nairobi, and every other region that will have us. And so we're going to have a flywheel of liquidity where a South African will hold and we'll have what we call a single share register across the world. We're also listing in London and in New York. So someone in London will be able to buy the share and sell it to someone in Egypt, say.
Brilliant.
And that's the idea, is that we become this corporation for the entire African continent and deploy that SME model in every across the continent.
I think it's important to, that the pent-up demand for exposure to Bitcoin is enormous. In Namibia, you can't buy, you can't buy Bitcoin.
Wow.
You keep going to all the African countries and it's either illegal or not, but they can buy a share.
Right.
That gives them some exposure to Bitcoin.
Clever.
So that, and if we get these exchanges to list us, and we're right on path to do it, that liquidity funnels in. And that's why usually with Bitcoin treasury companies, you find one company like us in a region. So in Japan, you've got Metaplanet. In the UK, you've got Smarter Web Company.
Right.
In the United States, you've got Strategy. In Brazil, you've got a company that just launched called Orange. And you normally have one dominant player. And simply because you have to work very closely with the regulators. And then once you open up all those channels, the amount of flooding that comes in is quite profound. And so we're excited about that. I mean, the pent-up demand across the African continent is significant.
It sounds terrific. There is the info up on screen right now. And as we said, you can find it easily, AfricaBitcoinCorporation.com. So Warren, Stafford, thank you so much, gentlemen.
Thanks
good to see
us.
You. Thanks for coming in to visit us.
We need to get you a Bitcoin hat, hey?
Yeah, I love it. Those are only worn by very, very rich people, as far as I can tell. I haven't seen anyone poor with a proper Bitcoin
hat. That's why I'll say it again. We need to get you one of that.
I'm sure that there's someone already working on a Hong Kong version downtown in Joburg. I'm sure we can find those as well.
Were there any comments from Bitcoin Boot?
Him and Wade says, modern monetary theory can't find peace between the goose and the gander. Snowballing rental properties, e-coin ownership, investment, yes, etc. are money for nothing, but the gander pays nothing. Mm-hmm. Okay, so do you agree with that from Wade?
Yep, that's the fiat thing. He's spot on.
Apparently, Bitcoin Boot says you can't trade US dollars in Nigeria, but you can trade USDC.
Yeah, he's talking about stable coins.
Mm.
And that's a different aspect of crypto. Yeah, those are stable coins. And stable coins are just merely frictionless money.
Right.
It's not Bitcoin.
Bitcoin Boot says he'll buy a hat from you. There we go.
No, buy a share. That's
buy
what
a
we
share, rather.
Buy a share.
Yeah. Very good. Okay, thank you, everybody. That's a look at some stuff that we haven't actually discussed for a long time that I think is absolutely important. And You gotta look after this, because no one's going to look after it for you. You know, they're all trying to get their hands on your money. I took my car in for a service last week, and they wanted to charge me like 70 or 80,000 rand to do like basic stuff. And I thought, you guys are insane. You lost your minds. So we'll have to see. Marius agrees. He says, I went out for earlier retirement. I had enough to live on. 15 years later, I can pay my rate. And every year I have to take less as my capital's disappearing. Yeah, that's what you got to do. You got to look for different ways to look after your own money. Okay, very good. We comment section's alive and well. I want to get Mash back in here. And we do have another guest popping in as well. So busy, busy morning. That guest is none other than Robert Benetto, who's also in business. And we'll talk to him about his feelings around South Africa economically, politically. There's so much to talk about there. But we'll get to that in a moment or two. Before that, I want to ask Mash quickly.
Uh-huh.
Yes, because you discovered that 46% of Gen Z workers, now these are people who aren't, they aren't even new in the workforce. They've been there 5 to 10 years, some of them, but they're certainly not like retiring. But 46% of Gen Z workers have already accessed their retirement savings.
Absolutely, Garrett. These are people just under 28 and downwards.
How do you access? I mean, are you allowed to access your retirement savings before you're like 65?
You are allowed to. Remember, we now have that the two-pot system.
Oh, yeah.
So you can zip in quickly,
take a bit of money. And that's what people were doing.
And people are just zipping in now simply because the cost of living is so high.
But they want to buy smoothies and fucking sneakers and shit, right?
The truth is, yes, yeah. Everybody is guided by this need
for...
Yeah,
they're not investing in property or Bitcoin investing, like Warren was saying.
They want the latest iPhone.
They're buying bullshit. Yeah.
They're like, the latest iPhone starts at 28,000. Oh, okay, that's my two-pot. Two-pot actually got 30,000. Buy the phone. The 2,000 rand covers Apple Care and a cover. And I'm done.
And now you have half of your retirement savings.
Yeah.
So when you get old, as one of the comments was saying just now, Marius was saying... You have no money left, and you wonder whose fault that is. Yeah. Well, it's yours if you fell for this two-pot thing.
But
terrifying.
I did do some research, though, on what are some of the underlying reasons for this.
Yeah.
And so this is what I came up with. So the first one is high cost of living and inflation. Well, it makes sense because the rising cost of housing, fuel, food, and healthcare, it's just so high that people are struggling to keep up. But those are needs. Another thing is wants. So the debt burdens. Everybody is under some kind of debt, Gareth. Everybody's trying to keep up with everybody. Social media is leading us into this thing where everybody wants to reach. Because actually, I'll give you a good example of what I'm trying to say exactly. Everybody wants to live a lifestyle that they feel like is better than people their own age.
Right. So they see this stuff on social media.
Yes.
Right?
So they're like, I want to drive the latest whatever, the latest newest car. Before everyone my age does. I wanna brag about how I'm only 28 and I have two houses, I have two cars. That's what everybody wants to brag about. Nobody actually cares about living and about what
and again
that
showing
matter.
This stuff off to people they don't even know.
Yes.
Right? It's bizarre.
It's so weird. Another reason is what it says here, emergency and lack of savings cushion. So, of course, people aren't saving anymore. Yeah. Well, how can you save when you're just stuck
you're
in
like
debt?
One paycheck not being paid away from bankruptcy.
Exactly. I mean, I saw Vodacom and all these cell phone companies are now offering 48-month contracts. What are you going to do with a 48-month contract? Isn't that, that's 4 years, Gareth. Who wants to own a phone for 4 years to begin with that you're paying for 2,000 rand a month? So people are digging themselves into these holes. Gen Zs, rather, are digging themselves into these. We are digging ourselves into these holes, trying to keep up with the Joneses, trying to be better than our peers and trying to look like we're doing well. And in reality, nobody gives a shit. Nobody cares, unfortunately. And another one is job instability and gig economy work. So a lot of Gen Zs are doing gig economy work. So they're freelancing. They're like just trying to get by. And job stability is also a bit shaky.
So you have
at the
1 month where you make a lot of money. The next month you make none.
And you blow all that money. You don't even save it.
Right.
You buy the latest iPhone. I'll keep using iPhone as an example because the 17.
Well,
just
they just brought out
week.
A new one, yeah.
And it's already has some issues, but we'll talk about that.
All right. I do want to move on to Robert. So Robert Benetto is a South African operations research scientist. He's also a chief technical officer and public speaker. He's got extensive experience in computational complexity, which is something we haven't ever discussed on the show, I can promise you. But Robert, it's very nice to have you here. You're based in Joburg, and you want to talk about a bunch of different things, some of it political, some of it to do with the way our systems work and what could work better. And there's been a lot of news this week that we can touch on too. But it's nice to have you here. Thanks for coming in.
No, thanks for having me.
Sure.
I mean, I think maybe let's maybe make it more about policy than politics.
Okay.
Right? Because I think that's something that's universal. You don't have to be political to be sensible, right?
So you're a concerned citizen who has some better ideas than the politicians, which is like 90% of us.
Yeah, I think...
The politicians have terrible ideas.
So my life changed radically a few years ago when I had kids. And it's a bit of a recalibration because you start to plan sort of 20 years ahead.
Right.
And you think, okay, well, I can get by right now and do my own thing, but... You know, what world do I want my children growing up in down the line, right? And there are definitely questionable policies that we have that's independent of whoever's running the country that we should probably be addressing, you know. I think that's really where I'm coming from.
I love that. So let's start with where you'd want to make the biggest policy changes. Where could South Africa have some easy wins?
Yeah, the simplest one that I can see is on the BEE side. And BEE is a bit of a contentious issue because on one side of the coin, we would all agree that we need transformation that works, right? Every South African, it's almost undeniable that every South African would want a stronger middle class.
Sure.
And the majority of people in South Africa were oppressed, right? Mm-hmm. And so you need to have policies that correct for that in the long run, not in the short term, in the long run. So BEE is a bit of a stick because what do we do with BEE? We turn around to business and say, if you must comply, you must do this, you must do that.
Well, we're even doing this with foreign businesses who have nothing to do with the history 100%. Of this country. And quite rightly, the Trump administration recently asked why they need to give away free shares to some friend of Cyril Ramaphosa's just so that they can do business in South Africa.
Yeah, so that's a very contentious point, right? Because there are a lot of historic deals that were done in South Africa that were BEE compliant, but there were no true BEE benefits.
No, they just made ANC honchos rich.
Okay, so we can agree that the system in its current encapsulation isn't really ideal in terms of benefiting the maximum number of people.
You say isn't ideal, I say disaster.
Sure. But the problem is that government doesn't see it that way. They see it as this is a policy that they need.
No, they love it because that's how they've made their money.
Sure. So I think...
MASH hasn't made any... You haven't got any BEE deals lined up, have you?
Nothing.
See, this is the problem.
Because
they don't come knocking in Klerksdorp. That's the problem.
Absolutely.
Unless
not.
You have a ringside seat at Luthuli House and the closer your seat is to the ring, there's no chance that you'll have
BEE. It only benefits people at the top.
There's nothing, exactly.
Yeah. So that's the question is, how do you turn it into something that greases the cogs of South Africa's economy, right? Because that's ideally what
not
you
the
want.
The palms. Grease is the cogs.
The cogs, not the
palms.
There you go.
All right, so what's your idea?
So my thing is, I can see a few problems with it, but one thing that makes a lot of sense to me is to, rather than say these are requirements that must be met by business, you make them optional. So you turn on and you say, you know what, these are the BEE criteria that we would ideally like every business to comply with. And here's the benefit of compliance. So you convert it into a carrot rather than the stick. And there's a couple of countries that have done this in different parts of the world where they want to drive some sort of transformation or some sort of job growth or opportunity. And they do this through rebates, right? So the classic example is Ireland, right? Why do Facebook, Google, Amazon, all of them have their head offices domiciled in Ireland?
Taxes are lower.
The tax deduction. Yeah. But the tax deduction comes at a price. You must employ Irish people and right. You must create jobs.
That's such a smart, valid point, because if you think about South African corporations, obviously the very big ones, they comply in every way and they get nothing for it.
Well, you get the opportunity to work with government, right? So if your BEE compliance is
which is the biggest player in the economy. But that could be used as a carrot rather than a stick.
100%. So you get sliding scales of this. So if you're completely non-compliant in a place like Ireland, for example, you get no tax rebate, mm-hmm. and that's fine. So maybe your business isn't well suited to employing a lot of Irish people. But they were in a very tricky position because they don't really have an economy. You know, we've got huge industry around South Africa. Mm-hmm. We've got railways, we've got exports, we've got mining, minerals.
Space, labor.
Yeah, huge amounts, right? Whereas Ireland is largely Guinness and dairy, right? That's what you can do with the land. They don't have mining, minerals. They don't have stuff they can export.
The occasional Hollywood movie.
and the occasional movie. And maybe a few episodes of Game of Thrones where it's nice to look at.
Right.
But that's the catch, right? So they needed something that said, well, how do we create a business? How do we create assets and investment and this huge pull into the country, right, without... We have to create an industry out of nothing, out of thin air, essentially. And they did it with this huge carrot where they just said, here are the incentives to moving your company here. We'll just tax you less. And the benefits to them are huge. So you could argue that this is a very unfair arbitrage opportunity because now other governments are going to miss out on the tax. So, but all they've done is undercut the rest of the market. So if you have your head office here, you pay a huge tax. Bring your head office here. We're very kind.
I like that. That's a very practical idea. What about Transnet? Do you have ideas around that?
Transnet's a tricky one because it's another cog that needs greasing. Transnet's a long story of really an unfair situation. I think often when we talk about economic growth, Transnet is one of those things that comes up as a result of people will say, but the railways don't work.
Right.
There's a very interesting reason why they don't work. And unfortunately, like most things in South Africa, you really have to wind the clock back 50 years. Mm-hmm. So if you look at the end period of apartheid, what the government was doing was running on emergency gas, right? They were in all hands on deck.
They'd spent too much money and had too much
debt. Well, also because of the sanctions, the coffers were running dry.
Right.
I mean, we'd learned to make fuel from coal. We'd done a lot of things internally to try and become self-sustaining. And one of the things that suffered as a result of that was the railway. So you need to, almost in your mind's eye, picture a whole bunch of blood vessels running through the country, right? And we have these big arteries like the National Corridor, our export lines, and then branching off from these is what represents small business, right? And so you have branch lines around the country. And these are lines that don't receive a lot of traffic and they don't run profitably, right? Because, you know, if I've got a little timber company down there and I need, you know, 10 wagons once a month, this is not profitable for Transnet as an entity. And what the apartheid government did towards the end of their time in power is they shut down all the branch lines that weren't profitable, right? Mm. So they actually restricted a lot of small business
small
growth.
Towns
small towns
stopped having stations that worked.
100%. And this was done to try and preserve the entity, to try and keep it financially stable without depleting the balance of what was left in the coffers. Fast forward to 1994 and a new owner, you talk about your car and maintenance. I like this analogy. You buy a new car, you ask the previous owner, does it run well? They're like, runs perfectly.
Yeah,
here are the
great
keys, have fun. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, coming in blind, they didn't have a lot of experience around the railway. So what happened was, is they said, well, let's look at what the previous guys were doing and let's make sure we don't mess this up and just do it the same way that they were doing it before us. And this was a huge mistake because, in fact, the previous owner had been neglecting the maintenance on this vehicle to a large degree. I was very fortunate over the years. I've had the opportunity. I worked with Transnet for about 7 years through a private company. And I've seen such fascinating things around the country. And I mean, one of the first locomotives that I saw was about 40 years old.
Mm-hmm.
Now, your replenishment cycle is supposed to be around 30 years on a locomotive. Can you imagine if your car was still running and you were still driving it 40 years from now?
No.
So part of the reason, and we've had locomotive replenishment cycles and other things subsequently to that, but we went through this huge era of neglect because really the guys that took over and had to start running this vehicle called Transnet, it wasn't actually in as good a state as people would have thought it would be.
So would your suggestion be to reinvigorate that and even to run at a loss if necessary?
So there's a bit, yeah. So this is the thing is governments actually, the world over, don't run railways at a profit, right?
Okay.
And that's strictly on the books because when you look at railways, the actual way that you do it is, because remember, you're the government, right? You own the infrastructure. Mm-hmm. You plow money in. And we've had incredible capital investment into our railways. Like, take a country like the US. You would think that their railways are some of the best in the world. It's vast and expansive. There's almost no electrification, right? We have a very, very dense electrical network. And one of the perks of that is marginal cost is much lower. It's 7 times cheaper to run an electric locomotive than a diesel locomotive. So our total running cost comes down because we've got infrastructure that's been invested into that's going to last, you know, the next 40, 50 years before it needs to be replenished. Just going back to your, sorry, you asked something just before that.
Well, would we run it at a loss?
Oh, run it at a loss.
Would it be worth bringing it back and fixing it and getting it going?
So governments do run them at a loss because where they make their money back is on taxes. So you run your railway at a loss, you stimulate the economy, and you get your money back over here. So it's an accounting
issue. And we know that this could do wonders for small towns that have become disaster dumps.
Yeah, hugely. I mean, the other thing is your general distribution cost goes up hugely. Mm. You know, we're one of the few countries in the world that has an internal port in City Deep. Containers arrive in Durban, they get put on a train, they don't have to clear customs, they arrive in Joburg, then they clear customs.
Right.
Hugely efficient, right? Mm. But the problem is we don't get enough traffic and throughput through. And a lot of this is operational complexity and other things that factor in. But it's very unusual, actually. South Africa is hugely unusual in many ways. But one of the interesting things is that our government in South Africa, or let's say the state-owned enterprise, mm-hmm. owns both the infrastructure and the rolling stock, right? And this is very atypical. So if, take a country like Australia, just as an example, and this is very typical around the world, is the government will own the infrastructure because the infrastructure is going to outlast any private company, right?
Right.
And this is why governments have an obligation to invest in railways, right? So your railway lines are going to be around for the next 100 years. Small companies should not be tasked with managing that infrastructure because it's unlikely that they'll be here in 20 years, right? That's the nature of capitalism.
Point.
So governments have this huge onus to invest in the infrastructure and manage it. But the government in Australia, for example, doesn't operate the train, right? And the reason for this is that's got to be your capitalist competitive layer on top of it. Private companies can rent track time from the government, right? Mm. And they pay for it. And like an airport, you know, if you miss your flight, Gareth, on the way down to Cape Town, you've missed your flight, you pay for it, you book another flight. That is how 99% of railways around the world operate. You buy a slot from the government. You say, I'd like to run a train at 9 o'clock from, I don't know, Ermelo to Urgis. Off you go, right? If you miss that slot, done. You're going to have to buy another one. And so government creates a revenue stream that's largely predictable from mm-hmm. the carriers that operate on the line. And then you have carriers that can compete on service level, you know. And so this is one of the problems we have in South Africa is the two are married together and the two participate in a way that's, I would say, not as optimal as it could be in terms of the way that the railways could operate.
I love this. And you're giving us a lot of detail and that proves that you know what you're talking about. Have you ever tried to suggest any of this to the powers that be?
So the wheels are turning.
Are you getting any?
I think it's interesting. There's a lot of...
there?
It's difficult because, you know, I think as a state-owned enterprise... there's a lot of pride wrapped up in Transnet. And so it takes a lot for it to ultimately collapse. Brazil is a good example of this, where they hit critical failure. They ran a Transnet-like company in Brazil for a number of years. And eventually a new government came in and they realized that it was do or die time. And they privatized the carrier network. So ALL Logistica, which would be kind of our equivalent of a Barloworld and Imperial, came together. They raised the debt from the government to buy the entire railway rolling stock and all the infrastructure. And then they operated like a private network. One of the first things that – this was about 20, 25 years ago now. The first thing that they did was they threw out all the chairs in the boardrooms. And they said, if you have time to sit, you're not running a railway.
Like
and
that.
And so there was a huge mindset, philosophy change. It was a big upheaval. But as a result, they run one of the most efficient railways in the world now as a result. They also do coal export and a couple of other things. And so it's
kind of, you're arguing against yourself here by saying privatized railways can't work as well.
No, well, they can. So that's the rolling stock portion. So government still holds the keys to the physical railway line. So
okay,
think of infrastructure.
Obviously, it has to be smaller, it has to be wieldy, and it has to make sense, and you've got to have enough money coming in and enough money to spend on maintenance. But when you're talking about it from a South African point of view with Transnet, you're obviously talking about a completely different kettle of fish.
Yeah, Transnet is more tricky. And we also, South Africa's vast, hey? We're 23% of the size of the US, right? We're actually quite a big country.
Amazing.
Geographically, which is one of the perks
of
living here.
You don't think of South Africa as being almost a quarter of the size of the United States.
And people always talk about the US, and, it's so vast and everything else. But geez, South Africa is enormous.
I mean, there are parts of the Northern Cape I'm sure that no one has ever been to.
Quite possibly, yeah.
I mean, there are only 20 people in the Northern Cape, right? Yeah.
Robert, it would make for a great solar
farm.
You
used to have a station in Klerksdorp. A train station? I'm sure there is.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
I'm sure there is.
It's never run.
No. Yeah. Of course, not in your lifetime.
But Robert, quick one. So Ish, do you think Transnet is capable of the change that you're suggesting? Because these are the same people who can't even order trains that fit on the tracks.
So that's a common misconception. So
that's Prasa, wasn't
it? That's Prasa.
Yeah.
I guess bad press is bad.
But someone else, it wasn't just you, Mash. There's someone in the comments who said exactly the same thing.
I mean, to give people a sense of the scale difference between Prasa and Transnet, you can think of Prasa as being 5% of the total traffic and Transnet being the other 95%. Mm. So they do get a bad rap for what is unfortunately not their baby. They ordered, I think, 1,300 locomotives over the last 10 years that all fit in the tunnels correctly.
Okay.
So you don't have to worry about that. The thing is that it's very tricky, Gareth, because the wheels are turning very slowly. There are carriers that are pushing to get private licenses, and I think that started happening now where and again, the devil's in the details, is that it's a non-trivial thing to operate a train on the network.
Sure.
You think it's like driving a car where you can hop in and push the pedal and off you go. Mm. There's track knowledge, driver requirements. You have to understand where the hills are, where the lights are from a safety perspective, because a child will throw a rock at a light and you'll be driving past and the signal light might be red, but you need to know that there's a signal light there. Driving a big train is non-intuitive. You're often accelerating on the downhills and braking on the uphills. Because the majority of the train is actually behind you on the previous hill pushing you over. Huh. And so you need to be stopping going up and accelerating going down.
You see, I never thought of that.
That's why I say the devil is in the details. And I think one of the things is Transnet does really well is they've got incredible driver training programs. They've got a whole school of rail out in Edenvale. But the catch is that the moment they bring private sector in to operate their own trains, how do you transition that safety requirement as well to protect all the rolling stock?
Right.
So I think there are complexities around it. But there are upsides as well to moving in that direction. So,
I know that it caused a huge amount of noise online this week when Helen Ziller and Anele had an argument. I mean, the clip I saw didn't look like much of an argument. It looked like Helen, as usual, was, I've got all the facts, and here I am with all the facts. Give me some evidence. And like Anele is just caught without any. So I don't know whether you saw anything different, but it was essentially about the neglected services in a place like Joburg. You live in Joburg. Mm-hmm. It's a mess, right? It's run very, very badly.
Yeah, Joburg has a problem in that I think for some reason local municipalities in Joburg thought that the job of government was sexy. And the job of local municipality is anything but.
That's the worst level of government. If you're into the sexy part of government, you better be president or cabinet minister level, because national government is dreary. Mm-hmm. Provincial government's even less interesting. Mm-hmm. And then municipal government is basically just, why are the lights out?
Yeah,
why is that electric box not working?
There's a huge analogy here between railways and local municipality in that, you know, railways provide these conduits to move huge amounts of stuff around very efficiently, right?
Mm-hmm.
And our water infrastructure is the same, right? We're moving huge volumes of water. If everyone had to drill a borehole in Joburg, you know, like this would be chaos. You want to move large quantities of things around. Our roads move large quantities of vehicles around. Yes. And our electricity grid is the same. You know, it's not feasible for everyone to have a little solar plant where they run their own power supply. Yeah. And so the first and primary role of local municipalities is to deliver these services. And that just, it really isn't sexy. It's hard grind. It's hard work. I mean, I have huge praise for administrators that do it well, because it can be a very thankless job in one way, and that you'll only ever complain when your water's not there. But you won't celebrate them when things function really well. Right. Okay, maybe they celebrate Cape Town quite well, but maybe because they've got the contrast, right? When everything's working really well, you won't even think twice about it. So yeah, it's an issue that we have very, very poor service delivery, and that's, at some point the people will get upset about it enough that they will vote for someone different, right? And that's what you've got to wait
for. We can only hope so, and I think that's the point. But as I said to Leanne this morning, I mean, this woman's 74 years old now. She wants to be mayor of Joburg. You couldn't pay me enough to be mayor of Joburg. Would you want that job?
I wouldn't want it.
Not a chance. Would you want that job?
Not particularly, no.
No, absolutely not. But there she is, Helen, out there with the, you know, the fire in her belly. I mean, I don't know how she gets it. So what else are you really passionate about in South Africa? I mean, you've taught me an enormous amount about what Transnet can and can't do. And trains are obviously an area of fascination for you. But what else are, to you, obvious areas of immediate improvement? Low-hanging fruits, stuff that we can all get involved in and make better, because it isn't just politicians, and it's easy to blame them because they are so shit.
Yeah, we could blame politicians or we could blame bad policy, right? Because the thing is, if you've got an ineffective policy, and it's called BEE in its current encapsulation, ineffective, then when you run the clock forward 20 years, you are... 30 years or however long you want. So the problem is, an ineffective policy is an ineffective policy. You're not going to grow your middle class. Our biggest problems at the moment are education and pipeline, if I were to say that. I've got a couple of colleagues that work quite closely with the Mathematics Foundation and look at modeling exactly how school learners effectively get through schools. And again, a very difficult thing to truly understand, and the coal face, it's quite an ugly thing, and you have to ask some very hard questions in that let's say in that environment, because our education, let's think of this as a pipeline. So Anele did get very upset when Helen pointed out that the statistics suggest that two parent households will breed successful children. That's not a mark on Anele or anyone else. That is just saying that the stats speak for themselves.
That's
the moment
true.
You've got more support at home, the odds of you being more successful go up, right? Generally, also two-parent income households have a higher nutrition rate.
Yeah.
So the actual proxy here is better nutrition for kids, keeps them awake and alert in school so that they can learn more effectively. You have to keep them going to school. Don't let them miss school. And get them through the school process. Where we're kind of failing again, and this is on let's call it a government level, is that our standards of education are becoming, we're kind of dropping them as we go. And you see this on mathematics is one of these things that gives you a very clear marker, because it's not, you know, I'm not marking an English essay where there are aspects of it which are subjective. But in mathematics, you know, we have, okay, last year this was this exam. If we give this exam to this year's students, how well did they do?
Correct.
And if
we could actually measure these things.
It's quite clear cut, because we have very easy marking when it comes to mathematics. And when your math starts to drop off, a lot of other things fall off with it. You know, mathematics is at its core a set of axioms that give you an ability to reason or do logic around things.
Sure. You can work out very quickly how good at pattern seeking someone is from their ability to do a very basic algebra equation, or to figure out the angle that's missing in a triangle if you give them the other two.
You remember your matric maths exam well. There you go.
This is it. Like a lot of people, and I was one of those people, oh, when am I ever going to use algebra? When am I ever going to use trigonometry? But it's actually learning the process of inputting whatever the value might be into a formula that teaches you about the patterns that are going on in business, that are going on in nature, that are going on in society. Mm. So it is important to know these things. If someone lacks logic completely, as very many people in the world do, they usually are not the kind of people you want to put in charge of anything more complicated than a vacuum cleaner, because they'll fuck it up.
So if we take that dropping of standards, what you're really doing is denying people future opportunities, right? And governments, aside from offering...
Is that what they're saying, or is that what you're saying?
That's what I'm saying. So let's look at this in the slightly bigger picture for a
moment. If you drop standards, you're denying people...
opportunity. Let me explain why. So if you take, at a municipal level, government is supposed to provide water, electricity, sanitation, hugely mm-hmm. important. Mm-hmm. Take a country like Sierra Leone, low sanitation.
And let's just remember, nobody imposed these regulations on government. No one said, you have to. Government, in their genesis, said, these are the things we expect to do for the people.
Correct.
So they've set that goal for themselves. They need to live up to it.
Well, that's a compact that you make. You elect these people and you Correct. Say, we are expecting you to provide these services, and then right. they don't materialize.
And by the way, those are the least of all the things that we should expect from them.
Sure. That's the minimum bar. Let's agree
on that.
And
we pay for those things.
We do. We pay a lot. So if you go one rung up from that, though, so we've got basic municipal services on the ground. The other thing that they're supposed to provide is an education pipeline and... job opportunities.
Mm-hmm.
Government is not supposed to be the primary employer. That's not a sustainable model anywhere in the world. And what government's sort of obligation here is to make sure that they are lubricating the private sector and your public companies as much as possible so that they can grow. Mm-hmm. Because there are a lot more private companies and public companies and job opportunities in that sector. So the more you constrain that portion of your economy, the more jobs you're taking away from people on the other side. Mm. If I lower my standard of education, it makes previous candidates look more attractive to business. Yes. And so I've lowered your opportunity level again. Because right. I know that the graduate candidates that are coming out now are weaker than ones that came out 7 years ago. Spot so on. If I've got to pick between them, I mean, I'm going to make the economically smart choice, right, for myself as an employer. So there's a lot of complicated – and the problem is now is it's a self-fulfilling cycle. So you have a 46% youth unemployment rate. So one out of every two youths coming out of school at the moment are not going to find a job, right? That is a catastrophic failure, and it puts a huge burden on the system, right?
That's why, Mash said, the ones that are actually in employment are already taking their money out yeah. from retirement.
Yeah, well,
scary.
You have one person carrying two people, right?
Yeah.
So that's a problem. And the issue is one of opportunity. Is there enough opportunity for people? Have you created the right incentives to employ people en masse or to even overemploy because you get a subsidy? So we're going back to the BEE thing here again. Yes. So if I'm getting tax rebates, I've got a quantifiable sum that I can put towards graduate programs, STEM, upskilling, everything else. So there's lots of aspects to that. But the problem where it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy is that you have, no one wants to be a criminal. Right. If I give you the option of earning a good salary or going out and risking your life trying to rob someone, you're going to take the good salary. The payoff is just not there. It's a hugely anxiety fueled process. And you've got to have sympathy for what breeds criminals in South Africa. Mm. And it is a lack of option. It's a lack of opportunity.
Yes.
And that falls squarely at the feet of our administrators. The people that are who have a moral obligation to make sure they maximize the opportunity to people. If you want to see insane growth in South Africa, you have to remove some of the friction around the job market so that you can actually have the offtake on that pipeline and then let the cycle loop back into itself. Mm-hmm. I think now, again, going back to my first comment about kids in 20 years from now, what do I want the job market to look like for them? Because unfortunately, there's almost nothing we can do for the next 10 years for the kids coming out of school. That's the harshest reality to stomach, right?
Mm-hmm.
Is that there's almost nothing we can do.
Yeah.
But 20 years from now, we could have a very prosperous South Africa, but we've got to make very difficult decisions now about what we need to do in order to lubricate that system.
And don't think it's just South Africa, because every country is also dealing with these questions. All right, so last thing I want to ask you is I'm curious as to what you would like to do about this. I think you've got great ideas. You're clearly someone who's thought about these things long and hard, and we need people who are able to do that. Do you want to do something with this, or are you happy being in private enterprise? It's not something that you'd want to take on as a burden. unsexy jobs in the municipality that you were talking about, not for you?
I already have multiple unsexy jobs. I sit on the trustees at our complex, and that's about as much administration as I can handle.
All right, you deserve a medal. Weren't you on that one, MASH, as well? You were on the
which one?
Weren't you on the body corporate or something for a little while?
Oh, no, I wasn't.
Are you sure? Yeah. I'm sure you were at some flat
in. I'd be a problem.
Yeah, you would be a problem. That's a horrible job, by the way.
It has its upsides in that you should care about where you live, right? And so philosophically, it's the same. I would love for the people that maintain our area to live alongside us so that when they get to experience the same water outages that we do, right? Mm-hmm. And so that is... would I be willing to do anything about it? I mean, I think this conversation, Gareth, in of itself is me doing what I can. I'm a nobody.
Sure.
You're a personality. You have personality, maybe both, a personality with personality. But I'm just a citizen, you know, that, you know, we endeavor as South Africans, we very much have a headstrong approach to, okay, well, we have this current crisis, we'll find a way to get through it. And, you know, that's how we kind of operate.
We leap from crisis to
crisis. We do, but we've also got to think at some point, we've got to recalibrate our long-term planning. So my contribution is we talk about the ideas, right?
I like it. I mean, there are probably people who are listening right now who are thinking of solutions based on things you've already said. And that's kind of how you start making a difference. It's the little things and in little directions. And I do think that we've got an opportunity to get a few things in this country right. We've done it before. We can do it again.
South Africa is a fantastic place. And it's mostly because the people are fantastic.
Yeah, sure.
Know, and it's you can't – everything else is rectifiable. It takes time and money and effort and a single focus, which I think Cape Town is very fortunate to have had with the form of their local municipality that they've had. But everything else is fixable. You know, culturally, you know, South Africa is in a wonderful place. You know, we've got awesome sport this weekend. That's like a huge uniting factor.
Yeah, I got into huge trouble with a friend of mine over the weekend. The public holiday. He's like, oh, were you watching the rugby? So I said, I don't care about the rugby. And he was horrified. Yeah, I know. MASH, you can't say that, right?
You can't see that. Yeah. You keep that to yourself, Gareth.
Chomotso, by the way, says, I think I'm in love with everything this guy says. That's you this morning, Rob. It's very nice stuff. That's all we got time for, though, this morning, everybody. So thank you very much for joining us. We will be back next Friday with a whole lot more. Send us emails, drop us a comment, watch the YouTube, like, reply, whatever. Subscribe, tell your friends to subscribe, people you don't even know, to the channel. We don't care. Right?
Yep.
No, we don't mind. Join us next week, Friday, same time, same place. Have an awesome weekend. Ciao.
Ciao.